It's one of the most ubiquitous phrases in the American criminal justice system.
The grand jury will indict a ham sandwich if a prosecutor tells them to.
You can indict a ham sandwich.
You can indict a ham sandwich.
A grand jury will indict a ham sandwich.
And you could indict a ham sandwich. Take it how you will.
That a grand jury can indict a ham sandwich.
You can get an indictment of a ham sandwich.
A prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
A prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich.
I have to prove to 12 jurors that ham sandwich is guilty.
A prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich.
Ham sandwich indictment.
Can get charges for a ham sandwich.
The phrase is shorthand for just how easy it is for a prosecutor to secure a grand jury indictment against anyone he or she wants, whether they're innocent or guilty. So what if I were to tell you that there were not one, but two men who have been wrongfully convicted for the past two decades based solely upon evidence that a grand jury found insufficient to indict them? And what if I were to also tell you that the only evidence against them came from an alleged accomplice who might actually be a third innocent man in the case? As many crazy stories as we've covered over the past 7 years of Undisclosed, you might think we'd made this one up, but it's true. And yet we might be on the brink of seeing multiple exonerations.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the State vs. Carl Willis and Wayne Brady. This is the first episode in a four-episode series about Carl Willis and Wayne Brady, who were convicted of the 1998 murder of 13-year-old Maurice Purify in Toledo, Ohio. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, Adnan Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Our story starts in Toledo, Ohio, during the early morning hours of June 15, 1998. On that day, 13-year-old Maurice Purify was walking home from his girlfriend's house on West Woodruff Avenue in the Roosevelt neighborhood of Toledo. Maurice's house was to the northwest, on Elmwood Avenue, but he never made it home. Instead, at around 4:30 a.m., two men found Maurice's body in between the two locations, lying in the middle of Horace Street, his feet facing south towards Robinson Junior High School. The men called the police, who arrived soon thereafter. Their initial belief was that Maurice, lying face up in the middle of the street, had been the victim of a hit and run. But when they flipped over his body, they saw bullet holes in the back of his head. That wasn't the only evidence of foul play. Maurice's pockets had been turned inside out. Also, someone had taken off Maurice's Converse shoes, which were next to his body. The Toledo police believed that both of these were evidence that someone had robbed Maurice and was looking to find money that he might have sequestered in different pieces of clothing. The police also recovered seven shell casings from the scene. These lined up with the fatal injuries found on Maurice's body. Four gunshot wounds in his head, one in his chest, and two wounds that could have been grazing gunshot wounds to his torso. Finally, the police discovered a bicycle thrown into a nearby dumpster, which might have been a match for the bike that Maurice was often seen riding. Police were perplexed by the murder of Maurice, who was known to be a good kid. Here's reporting by Brian Duggar for WTOL, which we'll be using throughout the episode.
Maurice was a basketball player, already taller than his brothers. He was a straight-A student. He was in church revival the week of the killing. He had a kind heart, easy smile, and was always there for his friends. At the age of 13, he truly was the heart of the family.
He was full of life. He always had, always make you laugh. I don't care what. You never knew when he was mad. He was just a special brother to me.
But the very next day, on June 16th, 1998, the Toledo police got an initial lead via their Crime Stopper tip line that conflicted with the conventional wisdom about Maurice. At 12:50 p.m., a caller called the line and, according to the accompanying Crime Stopper questionnaire, claimed that Aaron Pettis, a 22-year-old black male with a scar on his face, may have murdered Maurice. According to the questionnaire, quote, caller overheard a conversation that above suspect, i.e. Aaron Pettis, is the person who shot and killed victim. Caller not sure how reliable the information is. Supposedly, Maurice was selling drugs for Aaron and owed money to Aaron. Aaron's girlfriend is Cherie Davis. Possible address of 550 Hyatt Lane, McClinton Nunn Homes. Stays there sometimes. Soon thereafter, a Toledo police officer filed an affidavit for a search warrant for a man named Terry Lake. And if you're wondering how the police got from Aaron Pettis to Terry Lake, it's right there in the affidavit. Let's start at the beginning. According to the affidavit, on June 14th, 1998, that is, one day before Maurice Purify was killed, there was a burglary at Terry Lake's home. A neighbor saw the burglar exiting Terry's home through a window and identified him as Maurice Purify. The neighbor claimed that, based on the way that Maurice was slithering out the window, he would likely have scratch-type injuries to his back. The officer signing the affidavit noted that he contacted the Lucas County Coroner's Office and confirmed that Maurice did indeed have scratches on his back that were consistent with what was described by the neighbor. The officer was also able to corroborate two other pieces of information about the burglar that were provided by the neighbor. First, the neighbor said that the burglar was wearing a green tank top shirt, and the officer confirmed that Maurice had a green tank top shirt. Second, the neighbor claimed that the burglar was riding a green bicycle, and the officer again confirmed that Maurice frequently rode a green bike that he'd borrowed from a friend. The officer next noted that when uniformed police officers went to Terry Lake's home to complete a burglary report, they gave a description of the suspect of Terry. According to the affidavit, Terry Lake, quote, immediately stated that he knew who the suspect was who committed the robbery. This then takes us from the day before Maurice's murder to the day after his murder, June 16, 1998. According to the affidavit, a witness named Justin Williams claimed that Terry Lake and Aaron Pettis were together attending the St. Martin de Porres Festival on or about June 14, 1998. In the affidavit, the officer then wrote that he followed up on the information in the Crime Stoppers tip. He found that Aaron Pettis had a prior conviction for a drug offense and that there had been a prior Crime Stoppers tip from March 17, 1998, alleging that Aaron Pettis was into dealing drugs and carried a handgun. The officer then concluded the search warrant affidavit by stating that, quote, facts gathered throughout the homicide investigation tend to show that Aaron Pettis and Terry Lake are responsible for the homicide of Maurice Purify in retaliation for the burglary of the Lake residence, and because Purify owed drug money to Pettis. So, what eventually happened with Aaron Pettis and Terry Lake? It's unclear. The only other evidence we have connected to them in the investigation is that Aaron Pettis was brought in for questioning, demanded a polygraph test, passed the polygraph test, and then that's it. Given that polygraph tests are notoriously unreliable, one would hope that there was something else that threw the police off the trail of Aaron Pettis and Terry Lake. But, at least at this point, we don't know what it is.
Next, fast forward to either July or August 1998. At that point, the Crime Stopper line received a second tip in the Maurice Purify murder case. The tipster claimed to be a woman named Chandrea Rayford, and she claimed that her boyfriend, a young man named Travis Slaughter, had confessed to her that he had murdered Maurice because he owed him money. Soon thereafter, Toledo police officers came to see Chandrea Rayford at her job at Kaler Pharmacy. They then took her to the prosecutor's office, where she met with County Prosecutor Andrew Lastra. When Lasser started asking Chandrea about Maurice's murder, she refused to answer. He then asked her if she wanted to see some crime scene photos. Chandrea answered that she did not, but Lasser tossed them onto the table. They showed Maurice Purify lying dead in the ground, covered with blood. While shaken, Chandrea refused to answer any more questions. The following day, Toledo police officers came to Chandrea's house and showed her mugshots of Travis Slaughter. Chandrea admitted to knowing him, but denied being the one who made the Crime Stopper call about him admitting to murdering Maurice Purify. With Chandrea Rayford being a bit of a dead end, the police brought 18-year-old Travis Slaughter in for an interrogation on August 27, 1998. That interrogation ended up lasting about 6.5 hours. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of it next episode, but for now, here are the basics. First, Travis vehemently denied committing the murder or even knowing anything about the crime. Then, after hours, he claimed that he was at the scene of the crime when he saw some unknown masked man murder Maurice. Finally, he claimed that he was present when his former friends Carl Willis and Wayne Brady murdered Maurice because he owed them money.
In September 1998, Toledo prosecutors took the case before a grand jury. Now, a grand jury is much like a trial jury, except they're not asked to decide whether there's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Instead, they're asked whether the prosecution's charges are based upon probable cause, so that the case can then proceed to trial. Historically, the grand jury has served as a check against prosecutorial overreaching, and if you look at the probable cause standard, it at least sounds somewhat stringent. Under Ohio law, probable cause is defined as, quote, a reasonable ground of suspicion supported by circumstances sufficiently strong in themselves to warrant a cautious man in the belief that the person accused is guilty of the offense with which he is charged. But this takes us back to the introduction to this episode and the famous line about being able to indict a ham sandwich. Under modern law, a grand jury proceeding is the prosecutor's dog and pony show. It's just the prosecutor, the jurors, and maybe a court reporter or an interpreter. The defendant and defense counsel are not present, and they can't call any witnesses, present any evidence, or cross-examine the state's witnesses. On the other hand, the prosecutor can choose what evidence the grand jury sees and hears. Specifically, the prosecutor has no duty to present exculpatory evidence, such as the evidence connecting Aaron Pettis and Terry Lake to the crime. As a result, instead of being a check on prosecutorial excess, the grand jury has become a rubber stamp. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics data from 2010, at the federal level, U.S. attorneys took 142,000 federal cases to grand juries, and those grand juries declined to return an indictment in only 11 of them. There aren't comprehensive numbers for state grand juries, but data from different jurisdictions showed that the indictment rate is about 99%. And in terms of the 1% of cases in which grand juries did not return indictments, many of them involve cases of police shootings and a refusal to indict officers. So, what happened in this case? Unsurprisingly, the grand jury returned an indictment against Travis Slaughter, meaning that the jury agreed with the prosecution's claim that there was probable cause to believe that Travis was involved in the murder of Maurice Purify. But shockingly, the grand jury returned a no true bill against Carl Willis and Wayne Brady, meaning that they disagreed with the prosecution and found that there was not even probable cause to believe that they were involved in the murder. In other words, the grand jurors found that Travis Slaughter's testimony implicating these two teenagers did not even give them a reasonable ground of suspicion to believe that they were involved in Maurice's murder. For Carl Willis, this decision was a great relief and a chance to forge a path forward.
Yeah. I went home. I called a couple people. Like, I'm home. Like, I told you I ain't had nothing to do with this. And like, I knew you ain't had nothing to do with this. I'm thinking like, hey, I get my life back. Whoo, that was a close call. You know, man, ain't nothing, man. I told what, man, I'm about to change my life. I got a baby on the way. I'm about to get my life together, man. We've been playing it. We've been out here, and it's time to actually get our stuff together. He need to get it. Whatever he wanted to do with his life.
Oh, Wayne.
Yes, whatever he's going to do with his life, he want to play basketball, he want to go back to school, he want to get a job. Whatever you, man, live your life, man. Me, I'm about to get a job. I'm about to get really involved in my relationship. And I'm about to just fall back. Because that was the first time I ever was in something that serious and that deep. And knowing I'm innocent and knowing how the possibility of how things could have turned out then. So I'm never thinking about how it can come back, because I never thinking it was gonna come back. Because Peter Boyer, he seen me before we got released from Lucas County Jail in 1998, September 15th. He said, "Carl, the grand jury didn't choose to indict you, that they gave you a no bill. You should be getting released. The only way they can come back is they come back with new witnesses and new evidence."
And there was no new evidence presented to the grand jury for the next 3 months, 5 months, 7 months. During this time, Carl Willis and Wayne Braddy remained in Toledo rather than going on the lam.
If I felt that I was involved in this, that like a possibility if something can come up. But how can something come up when you know you're innocent? What do I have to run from?
But then, 9 months after the first grand jury refused to indict in September of 98, the prosecutor did indeed come back with new evidence. That new evidence came from Chandrea Rayford. According to Chandrea, she was in a four-way phone conversation with Travis Slaughter, Carl Willis, and Wayne Braddy. And Carl and Wayne admitted during that conversation that they were involved in Maurice's murder. With this vital corroboration of Travis Slaughter's story, the second grand jury indicted Carl and Wayne, and the case proceeded to trial. Carl Willis learned about the indictment from his dad and was understandably upset.
I said, "Man, this is some BS. I said, "Dad, I already went through this process before. I'm not about to sit in the county jail for something I ain't doing. I don't have nothing to do with this. How can they come with an indictment when they don't have no new witness, no new evidence whatsoever to come with a new indictment?" He said they had to come back with something. I said, "How can they come back with anything when I'm innocent?" He said, "Let me look into this." He called Pete Boyer again, and we went out to Pete Boyer's office. Pete Boyer said, "I don't know what the new witness is or new evidence is, but they came to the grand jury and said the grand jury rewarded them with an indictment this time." I didn't know nothing about Chandrea until the day of my trial. I never seen this woman, never heard of her name, don't know who she is.
Now, at this point, you might think that our description of this case in the introduction was a bit of a cheat. After all, while Carl Willis claimed not to know Chandrea Rayford, she told the grand jury that she'd heard Wayne Braddy and him admitting to being involved in Maurice's murder. As a result, wouldn't that mean that the trial jury also would have heard her testimony? Testimony that was sufficient to return an indictment? Well, the answer is yes and no. If that's confusing, let us explain. At Carl and Wayne's joint trial, Travis Slaughter testified against them, and the prosecution also called witnesses who processed forensic evidence, none of which connected Carl or Wayne to the crime. That left Chandrea Rayford. At trial, the prosecutor called her and began asking background questions. Chandrea testified that she was 19 years old, was a senior in high school, and had lived in Toledo all of her life. Then came this question and answer.
"Are you concerned about your safety today?"
"Little bit, yeah."
Chandrea then went on to testify that she planned to enlist in the Navy after graduating, that Travis Slaughter had been her boyfriend since she was 13, and that she planned to marry him despite his legal troubles. This then led to the heart of Chandrea's testimony.
"Now, Chandrea, because of your relationship with Travis Slaughter, did you know any of his friends?"
"Yes."
"Back in June of 1998, who were the people that he hung out with? Who were the guys his own age he socialized with? What were their names? Chandrea, are those two young men over there his friends?"
"Yes."
"These two over here, right? Those were the guys he's with every day, weren't they?"
"Yes."
"When you were looking for Travis Slaughter, where would you find him? He was your boyfriend. You want to marry the man. Where did you find him back in June of 1998 when you were looking for him?
Over Wayne House.
Wayne Braddy?
Yeah.
And Carl was always there, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And at that time, those three men did everything together, didn't they?
Yes.
This last question and answer led to an objection and the prosecutor rephrasing the question to ask, was there anybody else who hung out with those three that were close to them? In response, Chandrea answered, no. The questioning then turned to Travis's drug dealing. Chandrea testified that Travis was dealing drugs in June of 98, and that he was having problems with the person who owed him money over drug debts, and that they discussed these problems more than once. Chandrea then testified that Travis twice told him about killing Maurice Purify. She said that the first time, she didn't believe him, but then the second time, she believed him and was angry with him. The prosecutor followed up by asking Chandrea whether she called the police concerning what she knew about the murder. And at that point, Chandrea clammed up and refused to answer. The jury was excused from the courtroom, and the judge informed Chandrea that she was in court pursuant to a lawful subpoena, and that if she refused to answer questions, she would be held in contempt of court and thrown in jail. Chandrea, however, continued to refuse to answer questions, so the judge held her in contempt and sentenced her to 30 days in county jail to begin immediately. Here's Carl Willis's take on what happened.
So the judge said, we find you in contempt of court, 30 days CCNO. Boom. Right then and there, I'm like, oh, we about to go. Because right then and there, they supposed to stop the trial. If this your new witness that you got an indictment on, she don't want to testify, how can we proceed with this trial? The only thing you got is Travis, and Travis can get us an indictment.
But the trial didn't stop. And one of the frustrating aspects of this case is that defense counsel didn't even ask for it to stop. In terms of the law, a witness can't start answering questions and then stop midstream. In other words, a witness can't selectively plead the fifth. And if they try to do so, there are two options: a mistrial or a curative instruction. Defense counsel can move for a mistrial under the theory that some bells can't be unrung. And the case for Chandrea Rayford being an especially loud one is pretty straightforward. She was the witness who made the difference between a no-true bill and an indictment. She placed Carl Willis and Wayne Braddy with Travis Slaughter on a daily basis, and she testified that she was concerned about her safety before being held in contempt rather than answering questions. But despite all this, defense counsel did not move for a mistrial. Instead, he asked for a curative instruction, and the judge instructed the jurors as follows. Members of the jury, you are instructed to disregard the direct testimony of Ms. Rayford, since she is unavailable for cross-examination. As far as you're concerned, she was not a witness in this case. Does everybody understand, and we are ready to proceed? Here's Carl Willis's take on this instruction.
Judith Ann Langer said, disregard her as if she is never here. How can you disregard her as she is never here when they seen her?
Social psychology would support Carl's take regarding the difficulty of the jury in disregarding Chandrea Rayford's testimony. Think Dan Aykroyd in the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man in Ghostbusters. Or consider what goes on in your head if I tell you to absolutely, positively, definitely not think of a polar bear, whatever you do. Something known as ironic process theory tells us that such an instruction has a boomerang effect and actually makes it so you can't get what you're told to ignore out of your head. But in this case, we don't have to rely on ironic process theory. Here's John Cry, who is the jury foreman at Carl and Wayne's trial.
You know, on the same note, when the girlfriend was going to testify and then she didn't, you know, they came back afterwards and say, okay, forget everything you heard. Well, I'm sorry, you don't forget everything you heard. I mean, she's the only one that said these guys were friends, they hung out, and then she left. And, you know, I believe our assumption at the time was, well, obviously she's scared of these guys, and that's not why she's testifying. I mean, her not wanting to testify and her, you know, the few comments that did get out while she was in there definitely hurt them.
This thought process was not a surprise to Andy Lastra, one of the prosecutors in the case.
I think what was compelling was her demeanor. In sitting on a witness stand, looking at both Carl Willis and Wayne Brady, looking at us, you know, it wouldn't have taken, a rocket scientist to figure out that she was afraid of these two guys. And to me, I believe there was some aspect of that, a large aspect of that, that came across to these jurors. You know, she didn't have to speak anymore. They got the sense of what she was trying to say.
Two thoughts on this. First, if it didn't take a rocket scientist to connect the dots of how the jury would take Chandrea Rayford's aborted testimony, why couldn't defense counsel connect those same dots for the judge and get her to declare a mistrial? And why not at least try? Second, what becomes clear from the comments by both the prosecutor and the juror is that the jury convicted Carl Willis and Wayne Brady based upon testimony they were not even supposed to consider. Testimony was the only reason they were indicted in the first place. Because recall, without Chandrea Rayford testifying, the first grand jury returned a no true bill.
Now that is the law. But much like the jurors, you might be wondering about the facts. Maybe Chandrea Rayford was scared of Carl and Wayne, and maybe they even gave her a reason to be scared. And that might be because they were responsible for Maurice's murder. But that's not what Chandrea said in 2012. In 2012, Chandrea Rayford signed an affidavit. According to the affidavit, Travis Slaughter called her in July 1998 and told her that he had shot Maurice. In his first version of the story, Travis said he was walking Maurice home without anyone present. The affidavit then states the following. Travis said he and Maurice had been arguing because he asked Maurice if he could pay him to perform oral sex. Maurice threatened to tell. That's when he shot him. Travis said when he first shot him, he still got up and tried coming towards him, so out of fear, he shot him again until he felt Maurice could no longer get to him. Travis stated that he then ran and hid the gun behind a vacant house on Oakwood Avenue and went to a friend's house. Now, although Travis told Chandrea to keep quiet about the murder, she told her friend Rachel. In turn, Rachel called Crime Stoppers to report Travis and gave her name as Chandrea Rayford. Subsequently, after Travis's 6.5-hour interrogation, Chandrea visited him in jail, whereupon she says that the following happened. Acting strangely, he began talking about Carl Willis and Wayne Brady. He brought up our first conversation about the murder. He said Carl Willis and Wayne Brady were with him when it happened. He said they also shot Maurice. I was confused, and I told him so. This was the first time he mentioned their names in relation to what had happened to Maurice. I expressed my doubt as to what he was saying. Even after I disagreed, he insisted that he had told me about Carl and Wayne during our first conversation. I told him he was wrong. Travis also asked if I told the police what he had told me. I said no, but he said it had to be me because no one else knew about it. Chandrea further claimed that she later met with prosecutor Andy Lastra as well as a victim advocate and, quote, confirmed Travis's lie that Carl and Wayne confessed on that phone call to being part of the murder. This then went on to set the stage for what happened at trial. According to Chandrea, quote, I was very scared because I knew both the prosecutor and the defense attorneys would ask me about the phone conversation and the confession, which never happened. Then, when the prosecutor's questions at trial started heading in that direction, she stopped answering instead of perjuring herself, even knowing that she'd be held in contempt of court and thrown in jail. Chandrea closes the affidavit by noting that she had avoided the case since 2000, but that, quote, I decided to come forward today because I do not believe anybody should be in jail for something they did not do, especially when they have kids, as both Wayne and Carl do. I have matured, have my own family, and know that the truth needs to be heard. I believe Carl Willis and Wayne Brady are innocent. Travis Slaughter lied to the police and to the prosecutors to protect himself and his reputation.
Unfortunately, when Chandrea was called to testify about her affidavit, There was another twist in this case. Again, here's Prosecutor Andy Lastra.
When questioned at a hearing about that affidavit, though, she had no recollection of the affidavit. She had a recollection of the guy who put it in front of her and said, here, sign this, which caused Judge Gary Cook to be very concerned, understandably, that maybe during that hearing she was potentially going to perjure herself.
And so, the witness who wasn't really a witness once again, leading to Carlyn Wayne's appeal being rejected because she wasn't credible. And so, that leaves one real witness against Carlyn Wayne whose credibility is central to this case, Travis Slaughter. So what happened during his 6.5 hours of interrogation back in the summer of 1998?
I don't know nothing about that little boy.
You don't know nothing about it.
Next time, on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Of course, I'd like to thank our sponsors. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and you can support our Patreon @UndisclosedPod.